The views expressed on the Final Straw Radio do not necessarily reflect those of Asheville FM, WSFM LP Asheville, or Friends of Community Radio. Asheville Free Media, AshevilleFM.org. This is the Final Straw, and I'm Brissa Goodness. The show can also be heard on KXCF in Marshall, California, KWTF in Bodega Bay, California, KOWA LP in Olympia, Washington, and WCRS LP in Columbus, Ohio. Archives of the show can be found a week after airing at thefinalstrawradio.noblogs.org, and you can reach us for comment or concern at thefinalstrawradio@riseup.net. This week we speak with Jesse Cohn, author of the recent book Underground Passages, Anarchist Resistance Culture, 1848 to 2011, published by AK Press. In the book, Jesse explores trajectories in literature, cartoons, comics, music, poetry, drama, and other medium produced at times by and for or just conspicuously consumed by anarchists in Europe, North America, South America, and Asia during that period of time. We talk about what Mr. Cohn sees us as seeking to communicate, how we do that, and who we're speaking to, and how those questions change over time. More info on the book can be found at akpress.org. As a quick update on last week's episode about the hunger strike at OSP Youngstown by six prisoners, I'd like to say that Hassan announced on April 15th, 2015, that he and four other prisoners stopped their hunger strike. Cedric Tucker was continuing his hunger strike as of Friday, April 17, 2015, due to private medical malpractice issues, which he did not feel were being addressed by the demands that were met by the prison admins. The support website, LucasvilleAmnesty.org, recently stated in a post that the strike was a mixed victory, with some demands won and others not, with the warden conceding as little as possible. Hassan suggests that concerned people should contact the Ohio Medical Board and ask them to look into Cedric Tucker's treatment at the hands of Dr. James Klein. Hassan also suggests contacting ODRC Medical Service Administrator and asking him to send another doctor to review Mr. Tucker's situation. It should be noted that Sean Swain also had issues with Dr. Klein during his last hunger strike. Have a pencil to write this down if you want to contact ODRC's medical admin. It's Stuart, S-T-U-A-R-T, Hudson, H-U-D-S-O-N, Medical Service Administrator, 770 West Broad Street, Columbus, Ohio, 43222. To reach out to Cedric Tucker, here's an address. Cedric Tucker, S-E-D-R-I-C-K, number 117-137, OSP, 878 Coitsville Hubbard Road, Youngstown, Ohio, 44505. Writing to Cedric or in concern for him has real effects in how guards and doctors will treat him. What you say, what you say, what you say,
what? Record like a boss! I have some incredible and exciting news to share. Historic. World-changing. I suspect at any moment people all over the planet will be singing and dancing in the streets. We have finally attained that yet only figurative kumbaya moment. Reading through a U.S. court decision that upholds my lifetime video ban imposed by prison fascists, I note that Judge Benita Y. Pierce has declared that Americans may only advocate change through peaceful means. Yes, this is a watershed moment worth celebrating. The United States of America has renounced violence. Do you know what this means? Holy isht. Up until now, every single year, a cabal of white-haired wealthy old geezers gathered together to hatch plans for changing the world through violence. These geezers funded the violence industries with billions of dollars. Yes, I'm talking, of course, of the United States Senate. Good to know their days of changing the world through violence are over. No more appropriating battleships, tanks, Apache attack helicopters, and aircraft carriers. Until this landmark decision, the United States spent more than the next 15 militaries combined on changing the world through violence. No more of that. The days of advocating violence are over. If those senators and representatives continue that violence nonsense, you can expect Judge Pearson to march right into the Capitol with U.S. Marshals and have those violent conspirators arrested. Brave new world. And President Obama better watch out, too. Keep in mind, he's been obliterating hundreds of wedding parties all over the Third World, blasting them with drones. Occasionally, he accidentally kills a so-called terrorist or two. But he's going to have to knock that off to start living up to his Nobel Peace Prize and his campaign t-shirt. At least while Judge Pearson is watching. No more changing the world through violence. Imagine all the good we can do when we auction off all that military hardware and all those nukes. With the money we take in, we'll have the best educational system, best infrastructure, and best healthcare in the world. Our standard of living will skyrocket. Three cheers for Judge Pearson. Three cheers for the United States of America renouncing violence. This is awesome news for the Occupy folks, too. Recall, they peacefully occupied public spaces that really their tax money paid for. And the police came in with billy clubs, rubber bullets, and tear gas to change the world through violence. They won't be doing that anymore. I imagine Judge Pearson will soon be developing a program for collecting all those guns from the cops. And that means black folks won't have to have that talk with their kids anymore. No more Ferguson. No more Amado Diallo shot 41 times. No more unarmed kids shot 137 times by the Cleveland cops. No more Oscar Grants shot while cuffed and prone. No more Michael Pipkins with broken necks and jail cells. No more Malise Green shot to death on Detroit streets. No more Trayvon Martin. No more world change through violence. Fantastic news. It's particularly good news for me, too. I have to imagine that this new non-violent United States of America will be coming through the prison soon to collect up the billy clubs and the pepper spray. I mean, I can't think of any non-violent use for pepper spray. And I'll have to take that shotgun out of the perimeter truck. That means the only people who will be staying here are the people who stay voluntarily, who believe there's some benefit to their imprisonment. The rest of us can just climb the fence and go home. Prison fascists won't be changing the world through violence anymore. I can't wait to finally get home and hug my parents. The implications of this are so vast, I don't even know if we can contemplate how different the world is going to be. There will be a generation born this year who will grow up never knowing violence. I don't even know what that would be like. I was born during the Vietnam War, when millions of people were bombed and napalmed into oblivion. Then Afghanistan and Panama, Nicaragua, Beirut, and the oil wars. Constantly and continuously changing the world through violence. This is a new normal. A world where the United States of America has renounced violence. Judge Benita Y. Pearson may have single-handedly saved the world. This is anarchist prisoner Sean Swain from the Southern Ohio Correctional Facility at Lucasville. If you're listening, you are the resistance.
You can write to Sean Swain at his new address at Sean Swain 243-205, P.O. Box 45699, 1724 State Route number 728, Lucasville, Ohio 45699. To read some of Sean's writings and learn more about his case, check out seanswain.org. We're speaking with Jesse Cohen, Associate Professor of English at Purdue University, North Central in Indiana, and the author of the recently published Underground Passages, Anarchist Resistance Culture, 1848 to 2011, out from AK Press. Thanks a lot for having this conversation, Jesse.
Hi, thanks. Thank you.
In the title, what do you mean by anarchist resistance culture?
Okay, well, I knew that I wanted to write about all this amazing stuff, these poems and plays and stories by anarchists, this sort of lost tradition that nobody had really paid attention to as such, I felt like. And when I was trying to think about sort of how to group these things together and how to organize my thoughts about them, it seemed to me that function was extremely important, and that the real sort of functional tie between a lot of these pieces had to do with this idea of resistance. Particularly, I think of it as sort of a set of symbolic productions that let you keep as much of your mind as possible in touch with your ideals. This is especially crucial for people who are living in a world that is so out of key with their ideas. If you're an anti-capitalist and you're living in capitalism, if you're an anti-statist and you're living under a state, you not only are aware that those things exist somewhere in the world outside you, but are routinely having to acknowledge them and to comply with them. We could go down the list, patriarchy, racism, etc. How do you handle that? How do you preserve any sense of your ideals? So resistance culture seemed like a good sort of framework for thinking about how these cultural artifacts have actually served people in these material situations.
That's a really good phrasing. Can you read that first paragraph at the top of page 8? I and others I shared that with were really quite moved by what you had to say there.
Oh, thank you. Okay, yeah, so let's see. I wrote, to be an anarchist in a place and time that is like any part of the world in the 20th century, and let's extend that to the 21st, is to deny the legitimacy of almost every feature of that world, its nation states, its religions, its pretense of representational government, its organization of production and consumption, its patriarchal customs, its warped ideals, etc., etc. There is almost no end to the things one is against, to the point that one continually risks slipping into an entirely negative and reactive self-definition: anti-capitalist, anti-statist, anti-clerical, anti-imperialist, anti-racist, anti-authoritarian, anti-sexist, anti-anti-anti, when an entire society, that is almost everything around you, seemingly to the smallest detail, reflects assumptions contrary to your most deeply held convictions about what the world is and can be, namely the assumption that hierarchy, domination, violence, and injustice are the natural, necessary, and permanent characters of existence, then merely to persevere in imagining and acting on the assumption of the possibility of another kind of world is itself a monumental and continual effort of resistance.
For me, when I read that, I've read it through a couple times. I'm like, thank you. Like, and it makes sense. There's something, I'm sure, not only like propagandistic to a lot of the ventures that you talk about in the resistance cultures, and also something cathartic and something self-healing, or meant to sort of balance this out again, since we can take this metaphor or this experience and present it somewhere outside of ourselves and can look at it and re-verify, yes, that is screwed up. Okay. I'm not just crazy. It's the world around me that's crazy.
Yeah. Yes. Actually, the second thing you said that jibes most with my idea, that externalization, right, or materialization, really, of an idea or belief or desire, even more in some ways than the idea of propaganda. A lot of these works have been called propaganda or agitprop. But in some ways, that describes the function of resistance culture even less than what I intend. That implies that there's this external audience that this is completely directed to, with the effort to persuade, to convince, to recruit. And that's certainly part of it a lot of the time. But a lot of this seemed to me, as I studied it more and more, it seems very internally direct. It's more like part of the symbolic universe of a particular community, a political community.
I think you phrased it, or you may have been quoting from someone, but talking about this sort of thing as the stories that we tell ourselves, or the ways that we tell ourselves in stories,
mm-hmm.
as sort of framing and making sense of our purpose or our existence or our difficulties. I thought that was really smart.
Yes, yeah. And working through some of the contradictions too.
So can you talk a little bit about the title of the book? It's a really cool pun, that sort of an apt metaphor that seems to tie the book beginning and end and throughout.
So around the time that I was beginning to really embark on the writing, I came across this anecdote, which I just thought was so perfect that it just immediately formed this set of images that pulled together a lot of things in my mind. So the story of the two escapes from this notorious prison in Uruguay, in Montevideo, the Penal de Punta Carretas, which had housed political prisoners for a long time. So in 1972, yeah, there was this famous breakout. More than 100 Tupamaro prisoners broke out of this prison. They tunneled out successfully, this amazing kind of act. And in the process, as they were tunneling through the ground, they broke into another tunnel. And as soon as that happened, they knew immediately what that other tunnel was. It was a previous tunnel that had been dug into the prison to bust out anarchist prisoners 40 years earlier. These anarchist prisoners had attempted to escape through a tunnel that had been dug into the prison. They were so moved by that sort of recognition that they stopped and carved on the wall, apparently, here's the crossroads between two generations and two ideologies with a common destination, a single destination, freedom. So that idea of the intersection of escape routes, of tunnels, captured my imagination. I thought of that as a really neat set of metaphors for the way that resistance culture works as a sort of mode of escape, a way of kind of, at least mentally, finding your way out of a prison that you're in, and a space that you occupy in transit. It's not the promised land, it's not anarchy, but it's what Howard Ehrlich calls a transitional culture, right? Then for added historical irony, the prison is still there. But now it's a mall. It is this really ritzy mall in Montevideo, all the same layout with all these glitzy stores in it.
Little boutiques in the cells, or?
Yes, yes. I mean, talk about like consumer capitalism as a trap. But still with these old tunnels underneath it, they still could be used. I don't know. That just spoke to me so much.
There was something else that you talked about in the introduction with the amount of work and just artisanship, artistry that was put into the actual construction of that first tunnel that seemed that seemed to sort of like point to what you said earlier about the accusation of propaganda, that maybe that, you know, there are propagandistic elements or didactic elements to a lot of anarchist cultural productions. But also there's a lot that has been deeply thought about and deeply worked and in utter detail in ornate flourishes, some kind of artistry that's a testament not to that immediate escape, but building something sort of to last, not to replace an escape, but you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. That was kind of interesting too. The Gatti, the guy who attempted to tunnel into the prison the first time, kind of overdid it in some ways, sort of made this tunnel too elaborate, too nice. He was a real sort of engineer. That does actually parallel the artistry of a lot of this resistance culture. One of the things that I wanted to do is to call attention to elements of these artifacts that people who are struck first by the didactic quality, for instance, might overlook, that there is often a degree of sophistication and self-awareness, irony, play with multiple meanings, with shifting perspectives and so on, which is actually, I think, didactic in another way. It's instructional, but what it's instructing is not so much what is the proper political belief to hold, but how to think for yourself, actually. It's an education in critical thinking a lot of the time.
It's a really good thing to point out, the sort of like challenging of, for instance, in a story, challenging the actual knowledge of a narrative, of the narrator. That was something that I noticed and that I really liked about B. Traven's The Death Ship. Was that the title?
Yeah.
The narrator talks from this like first person position of, hey, you know, this stuff happened in my life. And then it becomes really clear that the main character is obviously talking around things that would diminish his respectability. For instance, visiting a prostitute. Mm-hmm. Like, no, I took her home. And of course, as a gentleman, I like stay there because she was afraid that robbers were going to break in. And then I stayed the night, and then I left some money on her dresser afterwards. And this is how I missed my ship. But the fact that Traven did that makes it all the more, like the whole story, then you have to do this critical thinking game and exercise of what can I trust of what's actually being said about the way that this world works, that this character's in. It was so good.
Yeah. Unreliable narrators are a feature of a bunch of these narratives. So yeah, like Han Reiner does something like that in one of his novels, a utopian novel with a very conventional structure in some ways. And, you know, an outsider visits this utopian island and reports back to us about it. But that narrator is a complete conservative reactionary who is horrified by his experience of this blissful, idle, and peaceful civilization and vows never to leave home again.
Oh, the return back to France.
Yeah, yeah.
So you pose in the introduction that much of the point of anarchist art is to respond to the question of, quote-unquote, how to live, while warning against ingesting the image or imagery as the real thing. How do you see this happen in your study?
That's a really good question, and it's difficult to answer because I don't want to fall back into an overly rigid distinction between imaginary and real. For one thing, action is real and imagining is an activity. It's even a material activity. And it can be thought in this very imminent worldly kind of way. It can be an activity of helping us to draw out the potentialities and possibilities that are latent within the real. And you could imagine nobody who reads the anarchist utopia Bolo Bolo, for instance, is going to put down the book, walk outside, and be fooled into thinking that the book she just read is a description of the actual world that's before her eyes. So the problem isn't really to do with just mistaking the sign for the thing signified, at least not that way. The danger, I think, is when imagining becomes an isolated and isolating activity, when the production and circulation of symbols actually comes to substitute for and block other kinds of social relations, right? So that Bolo Bolo, again, the author at the beginning quotes a line from a Brazilian folk song. If you dream alone, it's just a dream. If you dream together, it's reality. So right there, we're being invited to form new social relations through this book, to use it to connect one another and help reconstruct the social world together materially. But owning anarchist books, you know, and wearing clothes and hairstyles that signal that you belong in an anarchist community, displaying all these things as symbols of identity, that can become an end in itself. It can become this self-referential system of symbols referring to one another, that inhibits other kinds of action and interaction. So anarchist resistance culture can turn into what the sociologists call symbolic capital. Economic capital is money tokens we trade to get stuff. Symbolic capital is symbolic tokens we accumulate in order to get social recognition within our own small scenes. So you know, we turn into this culture, and subcultures have boundaries. They have gatekeepers. They have rituals of belonging, which tend to be exclusionary, which you can see make it difficult for our ideas to spread. Worse yet, you can have political identities that end up inviting exactly the kind of mistake that I just said that we're not ordinarily likely to make, mistaking the sign for the thing, right? So when someone says, well, you know, I couldn't have committed sexual assault, I'm a feminist, they're not just engaging in a cop-out, they're asserting that the sign, feminist, is more real than the action of sexual assault. It's like the student who says, I couldn't have failed that test because I'm an A student. Right, this kind of a symbolic tautology, the symbol pointing to itself. So identification is this very ambiguous kind of phenomenon. It can be useful for bringing people together, creating a spirit of community and shared purpose and trust. And it can also produce a lot of problems, especially when it's allowed to become rigid and reified, a sort of self-referential sign or an end in itself.
And so what role does anarchist resistance culture in terms of, so there's there's the creation of cultural norms and this social capital that people build to create an identity. Can you point to examples of when that same tendency to create culture and these shared symbols and shared stories gets used to challenge the hegemonic version of culture that ends up getting created? Like criticism, satire, any sort of thing that we can use or have used in the past to sort of like break down rigidity?
Yeah, well, frequently. So one of the most common kinds of resistance cultural practices is a kind of symbolic theft, right? So people might be familiar with the idea of détournement, the practice that was associated with the Situationist International, where they would, you know, take movies and dub over them with their own dialogue and so forth, and sort of invert or mess with the meanings of the original film, sort of turning this commercial product against itself. So, you know, similarly with comic strips and so forth. But that's actually a much older technique. So the wobbly songwriters like Joe Hill and Ralph Chaplin would write these union songs and anti-capitalist songs and anti-cop songs and so forth, using tunes that were totally familiar and that often, again, were completely alien in their political identity. So borrowing, you know, hymns from the Salvation Army to denounce religion as a total fiction and sort of an opiate of the masses. You know, pie in the sky when you die. That's Joe Hill's song. You know, and then again, there are also interesting uses of that appropriation of existing cultural capital in ways that are not necessarily quite so satirical. So lately, I've been especially fascinated with the example of Pietro Gori's widely known, widely sung hymn to the 1st of May, the Inno Primo Maggio, which is, you know, it's a poem. It's also a poem that's meant to be sung. And he set it to the tune of this famous opera aria in Italian. The Italian workers knew this stuff. Opera for them was still popular culture. It was something that everybody could sing this tune. So it's a tune from Verdi's opera, Nabucco. And Nabucco is the sort of retelling of biblical history, right? It's the story of the Hebrew slaves in exile in Babylon, you know, weeping for the lost homeland. And so at this certain point, there's this chorus of the Hebrew slaves, and they sing, va pensiero, va pensiero, sulla litorate. It's this beautiful little tune. Fly thought on wings of gold, it says, imagining this mental escape in very poetic terms. Gori hijacks the tune, right, and substitutes his own lyrics, making it into this song about the 1st of May as sort of, you know, the most important date on the anarchist calendar. He actually calls it in that song the workers' Easter. And I think he's really counting on people not only to know how to sing the tune, but even to associate his new song with the imagery, the ideas, the spirit of the old song, to think of themselves as the new slaves in a new kind of exile.
With a new kind of promised land ahead of them.
Yes.
I was wondering, it just kind of struck me, I recalled there was some references to Shaw earlier on when the literature portions were being discussed in the book. And between the picture of the dandy that's in Underground Passages at one point, you know, or the poser, I guess is how it's subtitled. And I had seen Man and Superman this year performed in our town. Huh? And I was wondering what you thought of This is totally off topic, and I know, but I kind of it was embarrassing because I went to the theater and I was dressed almost exactly the same as the character of the anarchist in it. We had the same facial hair. We had the same facial hair, like handlebar mustache thing. It was obnoxious. I just felt so weird the whole time. Apparently, I'm a stereotypical dandy from the late 1800s. But what did think of like the sort of like self-critical? Because what was Shaw's relationship to anarchism, I guess? And then also, which he was being denounced in some parts as being an utter populist and defamed sort of by some of the critics within your book. But can you talk about that play a little bit?
Oh, goodness. You know, it's been so long since I read Man and Superman and understood very little of it. This is back in college. Shaw, I don't know that much about his personal relationship to the anarchist movement in his time. He's a Fabian, and I think his attitude, if I recall, is kind of disdainful, politely disdainful, maybe. But the anarchists actually had sort of a mixed reception of him. Some regard him as not radical enough, especially compared to somebody like Ibsen, who's more straightforwardly critical. But then he did have some admirers. I think Augustin Aman, the French anarchist and psychologist, actually wrote a lot about him, and I think translated some of his work into French.
Okay, I'm sorry to just like pop that. It just happened to occur because I was thinking of images that people alongside of anarchism present of anarchists, and
yeah.
When you were talking about the hymn of the 1st of May, that made me think of that in some way. So Underground Passages was written with amazing scope and breadth. How long did the research take, and where did it take you?
Well, let's see. I first really got the idea in my head starting in 2004. This really excellent acquisitions editor at this university press, Amy Gorlick, contacted me. She saw something that I was going to be presenting at a conference in Vancouver about Kafka and anarchism, and said, "Oh, are you interested in that? Would you consider writing a book about something like that?" And so she just got me to start fantasizing about writing this kind of book. And eventually, that sort of snowballed into what became the project for Underground Passages. I think I really started writing it in earnest around 2007. And the process that ensued was really aided a lot by the massive volumes of data that just conveniently came rolling online right as I was getting started. So especially digitized archives of anarchist periodicals from the late 19th or early 20th centuries, which are just so crucial. They let you see not only individual poems or stories or images, but how each of those things is embedded in a movement, in a historical moment. You'll see this story by Ricardo Flores Magón. He'll write these little sort of anarchist parables. And then this lets you see it in context. You know, this is appearing on the same page of the newspaper Regeneración, the Mexican revolutionary years, right alongside sort of, you know, news from the front and manifestos, editorials, and so on. That really helped me to sort of contextualize things. So the first draft of this book was monstrously huge, and I'd obviously bitten off so much more than I could chew. There's just so much more out there to write about than I even knew existed at first. And particularly expanding my reading diet to include things that were in other languages more and more, I get getting bolder about that helped. I'd done a lot of my previous research reading sources in French and had gotten comfortable enough with that to start doing some real translation work. But then I started to read more Spanish things and Portuguese and Italian. Basically, with most of the Romance languages, even if I don't speak, I can hum a few bars and fake it, and you'll work through it with the help of dictionaries. You know, and then that sort of opened up much more. So for the first draft was incredibly bulky, incredibly top-heavy. I needed to cut a lot, and the reviewers, the peer reviewers, had sort of pointed out that I'd promised that I was going to, in the introduction, that I was going to look at anarchist resistance culture in Asia as well, but that I hadn't really done more than mention it. So I went back and taught myself a whole lot more about East Asian anarchist history, especially in the triangle of China, Japan, and Korea, where there's a lot of mutual interaction between the movements in those three places. And you know, really tried getting my hands on more materials there, you know, to push through that language barrier some, which was even more difficult. But it paid off. It gave me a richer and more balanced kind of picture. So that second draft, which somehow managed to be shorter and more comprehensive, got really wonderful reviews from the readers. Lots of love there. And so they approved it. This university press was going to run with it. At that point, a new editor came in. My acquisitions editor, Amy, was fired, and they started asking for all kinds of new changes and cuts and so forth. And I said to myself, why am I doing this? What is there some reason that this needs to go through an academic press? If you know about what those books look like, they tend to be extremely overpriced. They come out in hardback. They're priced for library acquisition. They're really designed not to be in the hands of a lot of readers. So I felt like this is actually kind of counterproductive. This is not going to give me the audience that I want, even. That's when I withdrew from the university press and came to AK Press and asked it if they'd be interested. They were extremely kind and did a due process and reviewed it and discussed it, but they were very enthusiastic about adopting it and had been extremely helpful in working with me to get through the rest of the production process.
That's great. I'm really glad they decided to pick it up because, yeah, as you said, like when I come across, like, oh my gosh, this is such a great sounding book. Like, listen to this title. Like, let's look at the, you know, description of this book. Oh, it's a university press, only published one time, hardback, $150 or something like that. And so to actually have this be something that's so accessible and yet still be written in a very rich and nuanced manner like an academic book is at times, like that's cool that it's actually you and AK worked together to make it accessible and get it out to people's hands. I appreciate that.
Thank you.
We're speaking with Jesse Kahn about his recent book, Underground Passages, Anarchist Resistance Culture, 1848-2011, published by AK Press. Since we're on the subject of AK, I'm going to skip forward and note that the publisher of Underground Passages recently went through a trauma of sorts. A fire in an adjacent building to the AK Press warehouse killed two folks and damaged a number of apartments, ventures, including 1984 printing and AK Press. Can you talk a little bit about that and the rest of more about your relationship with AK?
So they're part of the building itself. Fortunately, was spared from the direct effects of the fire, but smoke and water damage really knocked into their facilities. It's the heart of the operation. Books and equipment got massively damaged. So it's a huge mess, and they really need help to rebuild. This is not a small deal. If we're talking about contemporary anarchist resistance culture, this is one of the best established houses for the production and distribution of anarchist resistance culture today is AK Press. So I would love for anybody listening to this to go out, give them some love. There's a clearinghouse website for that effort at www.akpress.org/fire-relief.html, or you can go right to gofundme.com/akpressfire.
And they're trying to raise a hell of a lot of money. And they're about a third of the way, like looking at they're almost exactly a third of the way currently crowdsourcing this, which is great. Like, as I think I said before, when I was working for Free Mind Media, the little info space, like free bookstore and library in Northern California, AK was such a regular big help. And it was at the time, it seemed like basically the only thing out there. So their warehouse carried so many books that weren't there, some of them not anarchist, some of them Marxist, some of them libertarian, like right wing, but interesting information in them. And I'm glad they continue to put out such books as this.
Thank you. Yeah. A believable number of books on my shelves are AK Press.
A central thing that you seem to present being wrestled with and doing a bit of wrestling yourself with the question is the question of what is anarchist art? Is it in the content or the format? Is it for us to digest or for the general public? Is it defined by who produces it or how it is subjectively digested? Can you talk a bit about some of the go-arounds on the subject as you came across in your studies?
Yeah, okay. So in some ways, it's just another side of the question of what anarchist identity is. Who is an anarchist? What are sort of the boundaries of anarchism itself? You know, and there's some advantages to defining it in a historically specific way, right? Anarchism is this thing that does not exist as such until Proudhon sets pen to paper and writes, you know, Je suis un anarchiste in 1840. But that also obscures something. The presence of almost all the kinds of organization and ideal and so forth that anarchism was about centuries and millennia beforehand. So similarly, with the question of what makes a work of art an anarchist, I thought Josh McPhee had a really interesting handle on this in an essay of his Four Questions for Anarchist Art that he published in Perspectives on Anarchist Theory, in which he suggests that an artwork might be considered to be anarchist in any one or any combination of four modes, right? In terms of its content, its themes, its subjects, maybe also in terms of its form, right? Some way in which it's presenting this material might be anarchic, but maybe also in terms of the ways in which it enters and exists within the world, its mode of production, its mode of circulation. So is it produced in some non-authoritarian or horizontal manner, like a play that's written and performed by amateurs without a director, for instance, or being circulated in spaces that are part of a movement. So like what are called centro sociale in the Italian sectors, or the Ateneos, the workers' Athenaeums in Spain, or anarchist newspapers, for instance. You know, and finally, you might think of a work of artist anarchist in terms of really its effect, its function. What does it do? Does it actually contest authority in some way? Does it attack some kind of a hierarchical institution? Does it present us with some sort of utopian alternative, etc.? So I was thinking about all those different sort of dimensions of anarchist identity in culture, and I wanted to pay special attention to that question about mode of production and circulation, to look especially at things like stories that had run in anarchist journals and newspapers, for instance, even ones that were not written by anarchists, because that implies that we're getting something like a kind of appropriation or even sort of a canonization. And in fact, you do see the widespread adoption by anarchists of certain kinds of works by certain kinds of authors. So like almost any time you're looking at a political scene in the late 19th or early 20th centuries, and you see people talking about Zola, Ibsen, and Tolstoy, right? That like golden triad, you're almost sure to find anarchists in that vicinity. None of those guys, well, not even really Tolstoy, right? He was a Christian first, not unwilling to allow himself to be called anarchist, but certainly not adopting the title or associating himself with the movement. So, you know, none of them necessarily anarchist artists, but all of them producing novels, plays, etc., that were adopted by the anarchists and that became part of their sort of cultural imaginary.
Yeah, that's really fascinating how those names just keep coming up. Or like, you know, in a painting, there's like, oh, there's like Zola sitting up on the bookshelf or something recognizable, or someone's just finishing the last lines of it, or like putting up a poster for a performance of an Ibsen play.
Yeah. Oh, and like you can't even count the number of times that Zola's title is Germinal, right? From from that novel about the coal miners. That just becomes like a one word slogan for every anarchist everywhere. It becomes the title of like, I can't remember how many anarchist newspapers in different languages. People name their anarchist babies after it, right? Germinal Iglesias, right? And so on.
And I guess in some ways, like, although those producers that you mentioned are not exactly, they don't self-identify as anarchists and may have a critical relationship with anarchism, it does kind of point to this sort of crossing of tunnels that, you know, are trying to get to the same place maybe, but have their own methodologies.
Yeah.
An interesting thing that you touched on in some of your coverage of cultural production and anarchism was the relation between the artists and the audience. At times you point to moments of brutal criticism by, I'm going to totally butcher his name, but Osagi Sake, Japanese anarchist, I think he was mostly writing in like the teens and 20s, of contemporary writers, or the living theater being disrupted, or people standing during didactic performances and agitating for an attack on the scoundrel portrayed on stage, or the bourgeois in the next seat over, or appealing to the starving characters to steal food. These are all like great examples that you point to in the story or in the book. These examples are from many different countries at different times, but what did you see of those relationships between the performer or artist and the audience, and how does that seem to be different within anarchist cultures?
Wow, that's a really interesting question.
Kind of like when you were saying in the book, like, and all these examples were ones for me that sparked this like, oh, cool. People are being agitated in the crowd watching this play to the point of actually getting into fistfights and like the police waiting in the wings, knowing that something's going to happen.
Yeah. So, well, one thing is that there's often a kind of contestation of the relationship between artist and, say, spectator, right, or viewer or reader, where that the sort of hierarchy between them in more conventional modes of culture is sort of poked at least, right, or possibly overturned. So, for instance, there is a tremendous amount of anarchist culture that's authored anonymously. So poems that were signed just by a soldier, a hat maker, right, a miner, facing the author as this unique person with a signature. You know, and then conversely, you will have these theater performances where the spectators don't know that Richard Wagner, anyway, that they're supposed to sit quietly in the dark and be passive while this play is happening. They actually get up and act. They act themselves as if they're part of the play, as if the play is part of their world, which might be a sign of some kind of naivete. They don't actually know that it's art, but it's also very much like the kind of response that Bertolt Brecht famously wanted to get out of his audience, right? This experimental Marxist playwright, you know, was famous for writing these plays and staging them so as to achieve what he called the Verfremdungseffekt, right? The alienation effect. He wanted his viewers not to sit quietly. He actually had a stage instructions for the lights to be kept up in the theater so that everybody could see. He encouraged them to smoke, to eat, to drink, to talk during the play. And he instructed his actors to behave in a very ostentatiously artificial style so that the audience would be continually reminded what they're watching is not real life, but a play. And so that they would be in a frame of mind where they would disbelieve in what they're watching, to say, that's not how I would act. That isn't right. Why doesn't somebody stop this? This is absurd. And Brecht felt that would encourage them to bring that kind of critical spirit back to their own world, to look at their own lives as a kind of, maybe ludicrous script that could be rewritten. So we're getting something very much like that, even in these apparently very simplistic, very ham-handed, very didactic anarchist plays.
It strikes me when you say that about Brecht's style, and then it makes me think back to a statement made by, people interrupting. I think it was Living Theater being interrupted by people in the crowd yelling "Fuck Brecht!" and
actually that
and Goodman that having to walk away from it and be like, don't know. This is my role right here is to step away. And maybe I'm mixing up the agents, the active agents, but
yeah, the Living Theater was in some ways kind of reversing that. Yeah, so they sort of brought a different kind of disruptive maneuver in the 60s that. The example in the book is of a lecture, this sort of panel discussion about contemporary theater, which some Living Theater members are present at. Judith Molina is one of the panelists, but they just wind up sort of completely interrupting it and preventing anybody from having this reasoned sort of academic discussion about theater and yelling obscenities and so forth. That's almost, I don't know, is it the opposite of that earlier kind of theater?
Because it's staged and not necessarily, it's staged in a way even the people on stage wouldn't recognize. They've suddenly become a part of someone else's play. Whereas what Brecht was trying to do was create a situation where, or invoke a situation where the crowd was actually forced to engage as free agents. Is that where you're kind of drawing the distinction?
Maybe. I think that the Living Theater folks would say that that's still what they're trying to do. They were trying to interrupt something that's sort of ritualistic and to challenge, the distinction between artists and audience, speakers and listeners. But I think at that point, it's kind of ineffective, and the effect is ultimately just creating this sense of aimless chaos and anomy. Nobody's talking to anybody else. Nobody's listening to anybody else. There's just this sense of rancor.
That seems like the kind of thing where it may not be the intention of either of the parties, the people who are putting on the panel discussion, or maybe necessarily of the people that are doing the interrupting. That in and of itself does at least unseat the position of the presenters as authoritative. It kind of sucks for anyone who's actually there for the discussion, though, but I don't know.
Yeah.
Throughout the book, you frame periods of anarchist development and history, generally in terms of Daniel Coulson's proposed three eras. Can you break down those periods and what we're considered to be on that spectrum right now, or where we're supposed to be?
Daniel Coulson, who I need to completely credit with really giving me a new set of eyes to look at this stuff with. Really taught me a lot of new ways to reread the anarchist past. He makes a useful distinction three ways between anarchist history as it played out before the collapse of the First International, right? So that from Proudhon in 1840 writing, I'm an anarchist, through the development of those same ideas and practices, but mainly by just a series of sort of associated individuals, Joseph Déjac, Erné Cordroy, all these guys mainly in France, and picking up some outsiders like Bakunin. Then it really starts to crystallize as a movement with any coherence in the wake of the First International. You could date the second period, the sort of movement existence, from 1871 to 1939. Again, sort of a Eurocentric periodization. In some ways, that's obviously the high tide of anarchist organizing around the world in some ways, right? And 1939, the dramatic defeat of the Spanish anarchists in the Civil War looks like an ending. Then Colson argues that you can talk about a third period of anarchism happening really sort of when anarchism pops out of nowhere, making this surprise reappearance on the world stage in the 1960s, in moments like May 68 in Paris. Now, I really have reservations in some ways about that kind of periodization. It's always, you're always starting to fictionalize a little bit when you make neat divisions in history. And so, for instance, Andy Cornell has done a lot to show how 1940 to 1959 period, after the end of the Spanish Civil War, but way, way before what we think of as the 60s, that period is actually really important for the revision of U.S. anarchism. It's really part of that same process of reconstruction that Colson locates in the French 1960s. As to where we are right now, I would say if you have to periodize, the years from 1989 to the present, in a lot of ways, deserve to be thought of as a fourth period for global anarchism. And I now feel stupid that I did not write this in the book. But it seems clearly like a fourth period, just because conditions have changed so much. The collapse of the Cold War paradigm, especially, just opened up a lot more room for our kind of contestation. And revolts have become much more transmissible across borders, across cultures, even across movements. I'm fascinated by the way that tactics and organizing methods and so forth that we saw in Occupy, for instance, are now popping up as elements of the Black Lives Matter movement. That kind of transmissibility, that's a very typical feature of the Colson's second period, when a revolt happening in one country can just very easily sometimes find an immediate response in another country. So that what's happening in Germany in 1919, suddenly it's happening in Italy, right? And it's happening in Russia and so forth. We're in, not the same times, but something similar is happening.
A sort of echo, I guess.
An echo. Not summertime, but maybe a spring.
I can hope so.
Yeah.
In the conclusion to the Underground Passages, you state that a future and effective anarchist movement, quote, will have to abandon some of the themes and devices that have served it in anarchism's eclipse, unquote. What are these themes and devices that you point to?
Okay, I can tie that into what we were just talking about in some ways. As a slight digression, I'm very interested right now in another sort of way of thinking about recent history made by some folks in the Institute for Precarious Consciousness. It's been making the rounds for the last year, this article, We Are All Very Anxious.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so they divide up the history of anti-capitalist movements into three waves fighting against three dominant affects or emotions, right? So the dominant emotional climate of capitalism through World War II, they say, is misery. In French and Spanish, there's a nice pun there. The word misery also means poverty, misère. Les Misérables is not about sad people, it's about poor people. So capitalism kept us in line by threatening us with this brute material lack, and fighting capitalism meant finding ways to keep that very material threat at bay with things like strike funds. In the post-war consumerist affluent society, that suddenly takes a backseat to boredom. Boredom becomes the problem. And fighting capitalism means lashing out against boredom with cultural forms like punk and détournement. That is actually kind of the period of eclipse we're talking about. The decades after World War II, the French actually call them the Trente Glorieuses, right? The 30 glorious years. Glorious for the Western capitalist economies, but really bad for radical projects, which tend to get the dimmer turned way up. So
good
for the
anti-colonization movements in North Africa that were relating to, and throughout Asia that were relating to the former French Empire, though.
True. I mean, it's not so glorious for them economically, but you're right. The scene shifts there. Since then, capitalism has switched it up a third time and forced us into more and more conditions of precarity. generating all this free-floating anxiety. And so that also, here's the thing, I think that has implications for the further development of anarchist resistance culture as well. They actually suggest in that the document, if the first wave provided a machine for fighting misery, the second wave provided a machine for fighting boredom, what we now need is a machine for fighting anxiety. So but what if we took that up, this provocative proposal? What if anarchists need right now is a way, for instance, for people to really calm down, right? What would that look like?
Grounding exercises or self-care or harm reduction sort of directions?
Yeah, it's. I mean, when you put it that way, it's possible that this is already in development. In some ways, of course it is, right? But it seems to me like that's part of the answer to your question about sort of what devices we've developed that served us well during the eclipse or the low times that might not be serving us so well now. During those periods of eclipse, the Japanese anarchists had this nice term for that. They called them the Fuyu no Jidai, the winter years. So anarchism had to kind of overwinter. It had to go underground to withdraw from the public sphere and turn very inward. So the forms of resistance culture that we tend to produce in those winter years tend to be less populous, less widely accessible, less readable to outsiders. They may imitate or appropriate cultural forms that were developed for sort of an elite culture, like high modernism. In some ways, they're even designed to repel outsiders. So everything from beatnik poetry to punk rock. A lot of the latter half of the 20th century was this kind of deep winter for anarchists, especially in this country, in the U.S. And so the kind of poetry and music that we produced during that time tend to reflect that. They're disruptive, they're aggressive, they're great for expressing your absolute nonconformism, your boredom with capitalism, your identity as a conscious minority, but they're not so great for inviting people in, building bridges, broadening the movement. They're not really optimum for spring weather.
Some more picnics.
Yeah.
I definitely see what you mean. I also, like, in terms of, I kind of picked up on the sentiment around punk and, like, pointing to it not being necessarily a great avenue for actually expressing in-depth ideas in the moment, because oftentimes lyrics are screamed, the music is too loud, people are moshing around or people are like defending themselves and trying not to get their head smashed in by the person next to them who's just, you know, like swinging their arms. So I guess that, like, as an artistic form, those are like valid critiques. But in terms of the social forms that crowd around that, there's a lot of elements of, you know, the values of learning how to do for self, sharing with other people, potlatch ideals, community aid, whether it be like Food Not Bombs. I mean, these things aren't necessarily Food Not Bombs or Cop Watch or other potlucks aren't inherently a punk or anarchist thing, but the two kind of wed very nicely together for certain ages and in certain areas, and also certain demographics in a lot of cases. And it seems like the project of trying to, I guess it would seem like the project of trying to separate the like anarchism out of punk wouldn't really jive very well, you know.
this is where I'm going to get hate mail, I'm sure. It's in some ways I feel there's been an over-identification of anarchism and punk, yeah, and that sort of become one of those identity brands, right? It's a set of symbols that's so closely identified with anarchism and so closely identified with racial demographic, to some extent also with gender. It's very very sort of preloaded, and so in a lot of ways I think it's become as much of a hindrance as a help to the anarchist movement per se. It's certainly served a purpose admirably for a long time, deserves an incredible amount of credit for restoring and spreading an anarchist movement that had been brutally pruned back by the middle of the 20th century. Maybe it's time to broaden the gene pool a bit, culturally speaking.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. We definitely don't want to be, like, I mean, but we're also kind of, you're making a general proposal, and I'm trying really hard not to fall into a position of being like prescriptive or talking about anarchism as if it's like some sort of like monolith, you know? Like, well, yeah. anarchist this, anarchist that, anarchist North America. And that's like, so that's why I'm sort of stumbling with words, is like, I didn't discover anarchism because of punk, but I know a lot of people that did.
Yeah.
And I think that, like, the idea of a call or a challenge being proposed that, all right, let's find other ways to engage, and how do we shape that engagement with wider society, and how do we branch out more? Like, what are the artistic and cultural elements that could, you know, be at work in that sort of growing season, blossoming, you know? Yeah, I think it's a good question.
One element of that, the sort of limitation factors that come with punk aesthetics have to do with age, right? It's been one of the things that sort of identifies anarchism as a movement for young people, especially young men, young able-bodied folk, has to do with that. And what would anarchist aesthetics look like if they were better optimized to appeal to people across a spectrum of ages and walks of life? What is an anarchist resistance culture that accommodates, say, you know, parenthood and children look like? That's something I want to really explore.
I would like to see the product of those explorations.
That stuff for the book occupies on my computer. But for the next project, I'm thinking that it would be really interesting and worthwhile to look at anarchist childhoods, for instance. So we're familiar with the phenomenon of red diaper babies, for instance. I don't know anybody who's really done a lot of research
on
black diaper babies, so to speak.
Doesn't sound like a good thing. Phrase. Yeah.
No, that's not good. You know what I mean? That's a gap in the research.
Especially because, like, that's something, and I also, like, totally get and feel what you're talking about in terms of, like, projection of certain generalized, like, white, able-bodied, masculine, not necessarily all those things, thin body frame, participation in punk, and that overlap with, or that viewpoint that people present of those, that being synonymous with anarchism, and what would that look like otherwise? There's another thing about, like, the age is that, you know, like, when people age out from punk or people age out from anarchism, that's so distinctively different. And the cultures that were bringing anarchism to North America, for instance, and, like, they were family forms in a lot of ways, at least from what I can tell from some histories. But what is multigenerationality among anarchists look like? I wish I had, because we like tend to, or at least my experience as an anarchist is, I have my biological family, and then I have my extended network of comrades, and some of them have kids with each other, but so much of like this sanity that I think you express a lot of the people trying to, you know, stabilize themselves through the creation of cultural products, for me, comes from having this extended family of people that I care about and who I can share ideas back and forth with. And I'm totally blathering right now, but I'm excited to see what a history of anarchist childhood would look like.
All right. This is totally off the top of my head, okay. But let me take advantage of the moment to put a call out there. If folks are, you say parents of children and are anarchist at the same time, and you know, or if you are the child of anarchists, I would be interested in hearing from you about your experiences and how that's played out for you. If you want to email me at jcohn@pnc.edu, jcohn@pnc.edu, I'd be interested in hearing about your experiences. I won't print anything that anyone says without their permission, but I'd be interested in just gathering some folklore first.
It's been really great chatting. Was there anything that you wanted to, anything else you wanted to say before we part ways?
No, I think that's good. Just again, thank you so much for inviting me.
Thank you so much for having the conversation. Really,
this is a really unusual experience for most academics to have. we're used to not being read. This is a good opportunity for me to actually have to explain myself and maybe hear back from more people.
We've been speaking with Jesse Cohn about his recent book, Underground Passages, Anarchist Resistance Culture, 1848 to 2011, published by AK Press. More info on the book can be found at akpress.org. Asheville Free Media, ashevillefm.org. This is The Final Straw. I'm Bruce of Goodness. The show can also be heard on KXCF in Marshall, California, KWTF in Bodega Bay, California, KOWA LP in Olympia, Washington, and WCRS LP in Columbus, Ohio. Archives of the show can be found a week after airing at thefinalstrawradio.noblogs.org, and you can reach us for comment or concern at thefinalstrawradio@riseup.net.